At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done for 36 years this month, September. September 1982 is when it all began. The TechNet is a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, how it works, and they discuss it. They teach each other the art and science of radio and other kinds of physics. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and I have been the one constant moderator for this TechNet for 36 years, probably 6,000 hours worth, which is kind of amazing. You can see the last 12 years of TechNet. You can review them by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. A very enthusiastic guy named Mike, KC2NJI, has assembled that TechNet and been gathering all that information for the last 11 or 12 years. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play it all back. Some people can't. Let me drop this. This TechNet starts at 8 o'clock and lasts for 4 hours, usually up until midnight, and some people can't stay up that late, but they're afraid of missing something. So by way of those recordings, they can play it back at a later time. A few days downrange from the actual event, the recordings appear on that TechNet. Tonight will be a slightly unusual TechNet because of the holiday, Rosh Hashanah. The number of people participating will be definitely less. Roy AC2GS will not be with us. So we're running an experiment tonight. Are there enough people left over to run a TechNet? For those who do sign in, we'll have lots of time, so you can ask lengthy questions. The philosophy of the TechNet is there's no such thing as a dumb question. A dumb question usually represents the biggest difference between what the guy wants to know and what he'd like to know. So we don't take that snooty attitude thing that that doesn't come up to our level. Let me drop. Under normal circumstances, the first third or so of the TechNet is people signing in because they do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just to say we're listening. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. By way of the internet connections of Echolink and IRLP, TechNet does cover a number of additional states and countries, and occasionally we get sign-ins from other states and countries. Canada, for instance, as well as Las Vegas, just to give you some examples. A person signing into the TechNet, asking a question, is going to give me his call letters, his name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. The second third of the TechNet, under normal circumstances, is Roy, AC2GS, with the science talk, physics talk, but Roy will not be with us tonight. The third section is Paul, WS2N, with the space report. And hopefully, a lot's been going on with space, and Paul will have a nice long list of launchings and things like that to tell us about. Let me drop. So the possibility exists that tonight's TechNet will be a little bit more brief than others. We'll play that by ear. So who those who do have a question or a comment and want to sign in, please give me your call letters and name right now. I've already got Joe, and who else is there? K2RIW listening.
Yes, and Trio.
Rich recognized. Rich recognized. So we got Joe and Rich. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Chris, do you have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters. Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
K2UPS Mobile. Good evening, Dick. Yes, I have a question tonight.
Rich, K2UPS. Out of curiosity, Rich, where are you located tonight? Quite often you're mobile in places like West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Out of curiosity, where are you located tonight, Rich? K2UPS, maybe mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Currently in Ohio, heading back to New York. I'm in southeastern Ohio, crossing over a little while into West Virginia.
I could tell by way of the Echolink, I think you're coming in by way of Echolink, that you were out there many miles away from us. And quite often I use you as an example of how a person can set up a seemingly random wire antenna, or at least an antenna, a piece of wire that is close to a half wavelength long, close to, but not necessarily exactly, and you feed it from the bottom open end with a very simple one-stake grounding sensor. And believe it or not, that antenna can easily have a full 95% efficiency, even though a lot of people would doubt that. Very, very interesting antenna you've been using for a number of years. One last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
This is CBCL. N2QMU.
I heard N2QMU, Quebec Mike Uniform, I think it is. Please tell me your name, sir, and correct me on your call letters.
Call letters, Bill.
Okay, I heard you say the word call letters, which maybe means that the call letters were correct, so we've got Bill. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet who has a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now, and the word yes after that, meaning you do have a question or a comment. We have more than enough to get going. So, Joe, W2RYY, I often say, how are those electrons treating you at your QTH? But I should stop saying that because one of the things I quite often mention is that part of the magic of radio is that when you transmit a signal from an antenna, not a single electron leaves the antenna per se. That's not how radio transmission takes place. Really crazy stuff. The B2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
There we go. Okay. I didn't read my email, so I don't know what you said that for, but probably reference to my message to you. Anyway, my question is, by what means does electrical noise seem to spread out across every hertz of frequency? I'd like to understand more about that, where, you know, you get electrical noise, like, say, like a lightning crash, and it seems to occupy every hertz of frequency, degrading as it goes higher in level, what's it, 6 dB per octave or something like that. But what, by what process does that actually occur, where it seems to start from, like, DC and work its way up to all the radio frequency bands? Back to you, Dick. And maybe also possibly other noises, too. Is there, do they all follow the same type of phenomena?
Now, when it comes to kinds of noise, there's white noise, pink noise, probably black noise, and so on. Let's start off with the way it's taught in colleges. If you have a repetitive signal, doesn't have to be a sine wave, as long as it's some kind of a waveform that's repetitive, triangular, square wave, your initials written off the across the screen, so to speak, as long as the waveform is repetitive, there's something called the Fourier series that says that it can be broken down into individual frequency components. Those individual frequency components are sines and cosines of a particular, if you've got the right number of sines and cosines of individual frequencies with the right amplitude of each one of those, you can, with those sines and cosines, reconstruct your crazy waveform. When the crazy waveform, like a square wave, has a very brief rise time to it, a square wave has an extremely brief rise time, a flat top, and extremely brief fall time. The rate of change in volts per nanosecond, so to speak, volts per microsecond, tells you something about how broad band the signal will be. You and I could start off, let me jump. We could start off with a very sloppy square wave where it's got a kind of a ramp going up for the rise time, a flat top, and a kind of a ramp going down for the fall time. And when you did the Fourier series on that, you would find some sines and cosines, quite a number of them, but they would be grouped pretty close to the carrier frequency. If that square wave was occurring at a 1 megahertz rate, you'd find a whole bunch of components very close to 1 megacycle. As you started making that rise time and fall time faster and faster, the amount of frequency spread of your signal would drastically increase. When you take it to the limit, where the rise time is nearly 0 nanoseconds and the fall time is nearly 0 nanoseconds, you'll have a Fourier series, in other words, the frequency components that represent that signal, will be all the odd possible harmonics across an extremely broad frequency region. Radar has that characteristic. A radar signal has a very brief rise time and a fall time. So the rate of change tells you something about bandwidth. Let me drop. Now that's for repetitive waveforms. For a non-repetitive waveform, like say for instance broadband noise coming out of an amplifier. You've got a preamplifier, a low noise preamplifier, got a lot of broadband noise. You got 120 dB of gain in the receiver, and now you're listening to what's coming out of the loudspeaker. What comes out of the loudspeaker has a certain bandwidth to it, primarily developed, determined by the bandwidth of the RF amplifier and the bandwidth of the IF amplifier if it's a superhead system. But if there weren't any filters on that system, broadband noise would go from essentially DC to light. It has an extremely broad frequency region because the individual spikes, each time an electron decides to jump from your emitter to the base of your particular low noise transistor, it makes a spike of noise. Very small, but there's a zillion of them, and they're very brief. And that forces it to be very broadband. This is not the whole story, but pink noise, white noise, and so on is primarily a function of the quality of the noise generator. Let me drop. And the characteristics of the filter that's used in the system that's generating that noise. Lots of people build an intentional broadband noise generator in order to do calibration of a system. You can calibrate the noise figure of a system, in other words, the quality factor, how good is it at listening to very weak signals. The lower the noise figure, the better. You'd like to have 0.01 dB of noise figure if you can get it in your microwave amplifier. On some microwave frequencies, you're happy to get a 4 dB noise figure, which is pretty darn good at say, 47 gigahertz. But you start off with a calibrated noise source. You use usually a lightly biased Zener diode, which will build very broadband spiky noise for you, and there's ways of calibrating it. And by turning it on and off and doing a so-called wide factor measurement, you can quantify the noise figure of your receiving system. And that tells you something about its ability to listen to weak signals. That technique is a hell of a lot nicer than trying to put an extremely weak signal into your system to find out how weak a signal it can tolerate. Let me drop. For instance, a good ham radio receiver with a, let's say, a 3KC bandwidth might have a sensitivity where it can listen to a very weak signal of minus 130 dBm. The best signal generators you can buy go down to minus 110 dBm, minus 120 maybe. You can't get to minus 130. There's a very good reason you can't get there. If the front end attenuator on your signal generator could go down that low, and you actually try testing your receiver, you find out the leakage of the cabinet of your signal generator is producing a signal that's stronger than what's coming out of the front panel. It's one of the reasons why they don't go any weaker than that. So measuring threshold signal strength on a real good modern-day receiver is a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. And by using a broadband noise signal generator, turning it on and off, and measuring the change in noise power coming out of the receiver, that allows you to calibrate the noise figure, and that allows you to predict, with sometimes a fraction of a decibel of accuracy, what is the weakest signal your system will be able to receive. The weakest signal I know of, at the greatest range, which has intelligence on it that you really care a lot about, let me drop, is the Voyager spacecraft. Voyager is out there, I think it's 12 billion miles. Paul, when he comes on, will correct me on that. It's three times the distance to Pluto, is where Voyager is right now. And with approximately a 10-watt transmitter at 8.5 gigahertz, going into a 12-foot dish, aimed to the nearest tenth of a degree of azimuth and elevation, it's aimed very accurately. After 37 years, it's aimed very accurately at the Earth. And it sends a signal back to us. That signal takes something like 17 hours one way at the speed of light in order to get to us. And it's telling us what cosmic noise it hears out there and so on. So we can talk to Voyager 37 years downrange at 12 billion miles. The free space loss out there and back is something like 317 dB. I think the one-way free space loss is 317 dB. That's a weak signal. If you think you're going to make a signal generator go down to that number, when it goes down to 110 on the front panel, and you want to put a signal down there at minus 317 dB, good luck. So this gives you a little bit of a rundown of what broadband noise is like, and it's a very valuable commodity when it comes to measuring a lot of the parameters, like a false alarm rate and error detecting rates of communication systems, signal threshold characteristics, and so on. So you probably have some additional questions on this. You've just heard the 5% of the story, if you know what I mean, Joe. W2RYY, good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so for a non-alternating signal, you say something like a lightning strike somewhere on Earth, and you said, and I believe it, there's lightning strikes all the time going over planet Earth, and they ricochet all over the ionosphere and go here and there. Does the same principle hold true for them, where it's operating on one frequency or something almost like DC, but it's spreading out where you can hear it on every radio band, decaying as you go higher and higher? I guess it holds the same truth for that also, right?
You're very close to getting the right concept there, Joe. Remember, on that square wave, as you make the rise time and fall time more and more brief, the signal becomes more and more broadband. On your spectrum analyzer, it'll fill up more and more of the screen with very brief rise time and fall time. A lightning strike is an intense blast of very high current signal with a rise time that's extremely brief. If someone told me the rise time of a lightning flash is 1 nanosecond or 1 picosecond, I would believe it. Therefore, although it's not repetitive per se, it's got a hell of a lot of energy, an extremely brief rise time and fall time. And by the way, a lightning strike is almost never one single pulse. To the human eye, it looks like one single pulse. Use a high-speed camera, and you'll find there's 3, 5, 15 individual pulses in there, all separated by something like 20 microseconds in some cases. But every one of those pulses is extremely brief on its rise time and fall time. So therefore, it will be very broadband. Starts off at a very low frequency because it's not repetitive, and it falls off at something close to 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. Non-repetitive, fast rise time, spiky signals tend to do that. So a lightning strike, if your system is sensitive enough, guarantee you can hear lightning strikes even as high as 1296 megacycles and probably way beyond. When it comes to HF, let me drop 80 through 10 meters down at that so-called low frequency to a microwave, the DC bands as we call it, there's a lot of energy there. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of thunderstorms going on somewhere on planet Earth at all times. So those spiky signals are being reflected by the ionosphere, and they get to us. So the noise of a signal of an antenna looking on the horizon is a broadband noise signal, if there's not a local thunderstorm, that by the time you get down to 80 meters, it increases 6 dB per octave. The noise on the horizon, starting off at something like 5 or 6 dB noise figure at maybe 2 meters, and it goes up 6 dB per octave. And by the time you get down to 80 meters, it's like a 40 or 50 dB noise figure. So 80 meters is a very noisy band most of the time, as long as the ionosphere is working for you. So lightning is probably one of the major causes. However, let me drop this. The solar wind is a zillion charged particles moving at close to a million miles an hour, leaving the sun, hitting our atmosphere, and so they are another source of noise. So cosmic noise, cosmic rays, solar wind, lightning blasts at HF frequencies, that combined with all of the noisy pieces of electronics that the mankind of your town is producing, fluorescent lights and whatever, it can be a very noisy band. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very, very good. Interesting topic. It's always good to bring something like this to the net to, you know, I guess, open everybody's eyes as far as, like to what it is, because I'm sure everybody's experienced noise on different things from time to time. Okay, over to the next guy. Thanks for entertaining the question. I mean, it's Worldwide Wally.
When it comes to measuring the quality of a communication system, there are certain kinds of noise. Maybe it's pink noise, I'm not sure, but there's certain kinds of noise. Maybe it's called RIAA curved noise, which simulates human speech. Human speech, a male voice has a certain amount of signal, let's say 200 hertz and 600 hertz and 1 gig and 2 gigs, by way of a noise generator going through the right kind of a shaping and filtering network. You can make a broadband noise generator include essentially all of the frequencies of a male voice or a human female voice, and then you could play it through, let's say, your telephone system, put that into the microphone, so to speak, and see what comes out of the other end. And so you wouldn't have to sweep the signal. By putting that broadband noise, that tailored waveform noise, you know what you're putting in, and if the system is completely flat or it has a desired frequency response, you can predict what should be coming out of the other end. And doing a slow sweep spectrum analysis of what comes out of the other end, you can very rapidly find out the quality of your system, of your audio reproduction system. And you can do a similar thing for logic signals, computer-generated signals, and so on. So there's ways you can tailor that noise to have many of the characteristics of the signal you wish to send the desirable information, and then look at what comes out of the other end and make a very quick judgment as to whether or not your system is working well today. I'm pretty sure Ma Bell used to do that frequently on their audio circuits back in the analog days. The next person on our list was Rich, N2EO. And so Rich is about to have a beautiful repair of his standing wave ratio indicator that's part of his antenna.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Rich owns an antenna tuner, which has an output standing wave ratio indicator. And because of a component failure, see, I've been talking to the doctor that's doing the repair on that. Because of a component failure, a resistor that burned up in that antenna analyzer's output circuitry, it was giving a phony indication of apparent standing wave ratio of Rich's antenna. We don't know yet of the quality of Rich's antenna, but we do know that he was getting a false alarm from the standing wave ratio indicator. You put a couple of watts of power through his antenna tuner, and the reverse power indicator on the antenna tuner would peg the scale because of the lack of its internal terminating resistor not working correctly, and that's being repaired as we speak. But that may be not the question that Rich is going to ask us about. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. N2EO. Well, that's not totally correct. The medium on the tuner is not working perfectly, but the signal matter why the plates on the capacitor burnt up, that's not the meter's fault. Andy took down the antenna, rolled it to the ground. He can't find anything wrong with it, but there still has to be something wrong that we're not seeing. Because, you know, those are multi-conductive wires. They're on each side, they go out to the end, they come back to the feed point, and then they go back out again. There's something Andy is missing, I believe. Because if the antenna is fine, why would the plates of the output capacitor be blown so bad that the metal was destroyed? You had to put a new cap in there. So, I don't know. Bobby was trying to say he can't cut the ladder line down. That Andy thinks is totally incorrect. Because they never say any instructions. They never say anything in the instructions. about not cutting the ladder line. So, it's up in the air.
Yeah, when Andy took down your Cobra antenna, the 73-foot long thing, a very fancy antenna, which has got a folded kind of, the actual dipole is a triple fold twin lead like thing, a high power twin lead like, not twin lead, but let's call it the ribbon lead, is the actual two halves of the dipole, fed by open wire line, the whole thing in the center. The visual inspection shows that it looked pretty good. Whether or not you're allowed to cut the open wire line feeder, whether that length is a tuned length in order for the antenna to work correctly, is something we're going to have to find out about. Let me drop. And the other thing that Andy is in the process, Andy is WA2CDL, who's doing this repair for Rich. He also is going to be giving a good hard look at the 4-to-1 balun. The 4-to-1 balun is supposed to have 50 ohms input on the input end and 200 ohms of balanced input on the output end, and Andy's going to put a 200 ohm high power resistor on the output of that balun and feed the 50 ohm input signal into a bird watt meter into the balun to find out if it's acting like a 50 ohm load, as it should on each of the bands. So by the time the balun is checked out, by the time the standing wave ratio indicator on your antenna tuner is in good working shape, and the output variable capacitor that had arced over, that's been replaced, by the time all of this is in working order, the very last test will be a retest of the antenna to find out if it's still giving a reasonable standing wave ratio on each of the bands it's supposed to work on. And if not, then a further test of it will have to take place. And there's some chance, let me drop. There's some chance that one of the next things that Andy might do is use a time domain reflectometer. A time domain reflectometer is a kind of a radar inside of a transmission line. It puts out a very brief pulse, like a radar. If the system is working very well, that pulse will go down the transmission line, go into the antenna, and be radiated. And if there's something wrong, like if there was a short circuit halfway down the transmission line, the pulse going down the transmission line would hit the short circuit, reflect back, come back in a very short period of time. By looking with your time domain reflectometer at the amount of time for the echo to come back, and the amplitude of the echo, and the wave shape of the echo, tells you how many feet downrange is the error. The shape of the magnitude of the echo tells you how high is the standing wave ratio. And the shape can tell you, is that a capacitive load, an inductive load, a short circuit load, and so on. So a time domain reflectometer, something that not many people know about, but Andy owns one of those, or maybe two of them. That's the next thing he might use on your antenna to really find out if there is a fault, how bad is the fault, how many feet downrange is the fault. So it'll tell him where to start looking, if you know what I mean. And the test requires a little bit of interpretation. Let me drop it. If you're feeding a TDR into a dipole, for instance, at the center frequency, the dipole has got a real good standing wave ratio. It's a real good, let's say, 73 ohm load, so to speak, if it's a half-wave dipole fed in the center. However, the brief pulse from the TDR really has a lot of frequencies to it, so some of the adjacent frequencies, higher and lower than, say, for instance, 80 meters, if it's an 80-meter dipole, will give you an echo. So that now you've got to do a little bit of tuning of the echo that you're interested in to find out what's really going on. So a dipole is not ordinarily a broadband load. The TDR works perfectly on a broadband load, like a dummy load. You get no echo back at all, DC to light. But on a dipole, you will get echoes on the frequencies where the dipole is, because of its design, should be giving you a significant echo. So step by step, Andy is in the process of doing a divide and conquer. And for the time being, one of the things that you had to do, Rich, let me drop this, is when you saw a high apparent standing wave ratio, the thing you should not do in that case is to put a kilowatt or 1,500 watts of power into the antenna when you're getting that indication. If the power coming out of the amplifier, going through the antenna tuner, going through the balun, going into the antenna, if that power is not being properly absorbed, if because of high standing wave ratio, a lot of it is being reflected back, it's going to give you grief. The highly reflected power means that the voltages on the tuning capacitors and inductor of the antenna tuner go sky high. The voltage on the standing wave ratio indicator goes sky high. So when there was a high standing wave ratio, to continue to put high power into that antenna, hoping to make QSOs, is a destructive process. So in the future, my recommendation, Rich, is that you start off with a low amount of power, measure what the standing wave ratio is before increasing the power. And if you do find a standing wave ratio higher than, let's say, 2 to 1 or 3 to 1, find out what's causing that and fix it first before putting a kilowatt into it and burning up your equipment. So when it comes to the damage of the equipment, there's a chance that you had a contributing factor there, Rich, where you hadn't been given this kind of instruction as to how to do the step-by-step process before hitting a system with high power, which could be destructive. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead. Oh, by the way, Rich, back away from the microphone. You're so close to it that you're at the threshold of giving out square waves and distorting. And you've done that a few times during transmissions over the last few days. So you're going to have to back away from that microphone, Rich. N2EO, or turn down the audio gain. N2EO, after the beeps, K2RIW to TechNet.
Okay, good. More for more. I'll leave the audio now.
That sounds just about right, Rich.
All right. You know, the strange thing about all this, the last time I used the radio, there was absolutely no problem when I signed off. When I went back on the radio with high power, because I had no inkling anything was wrong, that's when a disaster happened.
Yeah, your output standing wave indicator on your antenna tuner does not absorb any power. What a number of people will do is to leave it switched into the reverse power mode. In other words, it's looking at reflected power from the antenna, and so they have the meter continuously measuring that. And hopefully, if the antenna is working well, there's very little reflected power. If you're running 100 watts and you're getting 3 watts reflected, and you're continuously looking at that, everything's hunky-dory. And so each time you turn the rig back on, rainy day, sunny day, whatever, windy day, and you're looking at that reverse power meter on your antenna tuner, if you start seeing it rise to unusual numbers, then you know to stop before hitting it with high power because you might do damage to the system. So in the future, I recommend you continuously look at the reverse power indication on that standing wave indicator of your antenna tuner. Over to you, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Well, that's a good point, Dick. I will do that in the future. By the way, the meter is a crosshair meter. Forward, reverse, and SWR.
Yeah, I think you're telling me it's got two needles to it. One needle indicates forward power, one needle indicates reverse power, and where the two needles cross each other, crosshair like you said, then there's another scale that you read that interprets that into standing wave ratio. That's a very handy device. So, do look at that, and look at particularly the needle indicating reverse power. Each day when you turn the rig back on, start off at low power and look at that indicator to know that everything's hunky-dory before you hit it with high power. Otherwise, you could repeat the process of burning up your output tuning capacitor that got melted down and so on. So, okay, we're going to go over to Rich next. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, who I think is in Ohio. I think he's heading toward Pennsylvania. He's on his way back to New York. If I know him, he's traveling along at about 60 miles an hour with probably a 40,000-pound rig that's probably 40 feet long. And as he rolls along, he talks to us. K2UPS, K2RIW. Correct me on those numbers, Rich.
Okay, K2UPS, mobile. Well, the whole thing could weigh up to 80,000 pounds, but they don't weigh these. They're just filled with packages, and they very rarely reach maximum weighing. But there's two trailers, and my total length, bumper to bumper, is about 75 feet. And right now I'm near Wheeling, West Virginia. My question is, I'm wondering if you have any knowledge on resident speakers specifically applied to listening to CW signals. I've read a lot of articles about them, gathered some PVC pipe to build them, and then I recently came across some plans for a 3D printed one that a friend of mine has volunteered to print out for me so I can check it out. Very neat device, particularly on an older radio that may not have a good filtering in it, or if you're, even if you're trying to tune in weak signal, CW signal, it could be very handy, and you can make it so it's tuned for a very specific audio frequency, say 600 hertz or 700 hertz, or you can make it adjustable, kind of like a trombone with a sliding feature, so you can vary it a little bit. But I'm just wondering what you know about them, Dick. Thank you.
Yeah, Alan Katz, K2UIH, Uniform Yankee Hotel. Arguably the guy who's done more moon bounce than anybody else on planet Earth, and he's been publishing a journal for the last 40 years, the EME News or something like that is the name of it, where all the worldwide moon bounce people report to him, and he reports in this monthly journal what's going on in the world of moon bounce guys on 2 meters and 432 and 1296 and so on, and they've been doing moon bounce up to, I think, 47 gigahertz. One of the experiments that they've discovered, and by the way, the weakest signal that ham radio operators ever use, arguably, is a moonbound signal. On, for instance, 432 megahertz, use your 1,500 watt output amplifier into 16 Yagis, where each Yagi has got 19 elements, so to speak. It's an antenna that's 20 feet wide, 20 feet high. So you've got 400 square feet of antenna with 1,500 watts into it. 29 dB of gain on that antenna aimed at the moon. Let me drop it. That antenna gives you close to a million watts of effective isotropic radiated power. You aim that at the moon, and at 432 megahertz, the moon echo comes back to you 263 decibels weaker than what you send. So the signal you get back is not a microvolt. It's probably a nanovolt. It's a signal of minus 150 dBm or something like that, an extremely weak CW signal when you're doing it by non-computer techniques. So a human being listening to that very weak signal in that noise, a trained ear, can hear that signal, and let me drop. If you've adjusted the frequency of the receiver such that your favorite tone is maybe 700 hertz, coming out of that loudspeaker, that very weak signal in the noise, and the human ear hears that 700 hertz, and you listen to that Morse code of the guy confirming that he's heard your signal and the signal report off the moon, and now it's a valid contact. The most pleasant way to listen to that would be with a digital signal processor, in my opinion, a digital signal processor set at 700 hertz center frequency, and you select the bandwidth and damping factor of the 700 hertz bandwidth filter that you set up your digital signal analyzer with. Because of digital signal processing these days, you can make the shape anything you want. You can decide how much low-pass filter function, how much high-pass filter function, how much damping function, how much bandwidth, and so on. How flat is the passband? You can get an awful lot of characteristics out of a properly designed, properly used digital signal processor. Let me drop. In the old days, before digital signal processing and high-power computing systems existed, people would intentionally build, let me call it a highly modified bass reflex baffle. In other words, there's ways you can take a particular loudspeaker, mount it into a particular enclosure, where the speaker plus its enclosure favors some particular frequency, like 700 hertz. So you can do it in a purely mechanical manner in the old days. It is my guess that other than people who want to do it for historic reasons or as a science experiment, I think the average moon bouncer these days would not do it that way. He does it with a digital signal processor applied to either the audio or the IF system of his moon bounce receiver. So those are some of my feelings on that. You can build an extremely narrow filter at 700 hertz. You can make the filter 5 hertz wide. However, a 500 hertz wide filter would have, by the laws of physics, a very sloppy rise time and fall time. It would give you a smeared signal. You'd only be able to listen to Morse code through that 5 hertz filter at the you know, 2 words per minute, so to speak, which is an uncomfortably slow speed. So there's a compromise between the proper bandwidth of the filter, the proper damping factor of the filter, the slope of the lower skirt, the slope of the higher skirt. There's ways of tailoring the filter that does the best job for your particular environment in your particular set of hearing ears. Let me drop. Now, if your system was operating a strip chart recorder or something like that, you'd like the filter to be as narrow as possible, centered on the signal of interest when you make the recording of the moon bounce signal coming off the moon. However, if it's a human ear listening to the signal, another whole set of criteria takes place. K2UIH and his group of guys have done a whole lot of audition, I'm going to call it, in other words, a human audio experiment, where they made a very interesting discovery. Take a carefully tailored filter at 700 hertz, listening to a weak CW signal, and you slowly increase the bandwidth of that filter to eventually the filter is, let me pick a number, 5 kilohertz wide. You're listening to a whole lot of broadband noise with that weak signal inside of it. Run that signal into a strip shot recorder and nothing would appear on the screen. Run that signal into a very well-trained set of human ears listening to that signal, and the human hearing, with training, can narrow itself down to a 50 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth. So the final filter in that system, even though the real audio coming out is 5 kilohertz wide, the final filter would be 50 hertz wide. It is what's going on between those two ears and inside that human brain. So what they've discovered is that a trained moonbounce listener, whether he's using a broadband filter or a narrowband filter, his threshold of how weak a signal he can listen to is approximately the same. Let me drop. That's for the trained operator. If his wife walks into the room and he wants the wife to hear this threshold moonbounce signal for this brand new country he just got, and he's jumping up and down with enthusiasm, he wants her to hear the signal, and he plays it to her over a loudspeaker, she will never hear that signal unless it's in a narrow filter. She hasn't got the training. She would say there's nothing there but noise, unless it was a very narrow filter centered on the signal. But he, the trained operator, doesn't necessarily need the narrow filter, because the human processing can do that for you. Ain't that crazy? So in other words, when it comes to explaining the so-called cocktail party effect, where in theory, as long as your eyes can see the lips of the person across the room that's speaking in this cocktail party, there are times when you can interpret what that person is saying, even though there's a hell of a lot of other conversations going on that are a lot louder. The human ear, the human brain, earing, eye system can do all kinds of other processing that's not immediately obvious at first. K2UPS, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Time with a comment?
Rich first, and then we'll go over to the person with the comment. Go ahead, Rich.
K2UPS Mobile, and I do agree with you, Dick, that a trained operator's ears are the best filter around. However, even a good trained operator, it can get very tiring in a very short amount of time having to do that without an external aid to help them with the filtering. Some guys can do it for a long time, others maybe just 5 or 10 minutes, and then that's it. They get, you know, fried. They have to put it down or take the headphones off. Although I do know some people, too, who can copy up to, you know, 3 or more streams of Morse code at the same time coming out of the same speaker and understand all 3 of them, which is not good. I mean, I'd like to get to that point, but not yet. And I agree that the digital signal processing is great, but I'm talking about a very simple device. Usually it's a small speaker, maybe 2 to 3 inches in diameter, that gets glued and sealed into the end of a tube, whether it be cardboard or PVC, or in the case of the most recent one I'm going to try is a 3D printed model. And then due to the diameter of the tube, the length of the tube, all that specifics goes into play to determine the frequency that a particular tube will highlight. And they do say, in every article I've read about them, that they can be extremely narrow-banded and you should not use this for general tuning around. You know, use a regular speaker and have a switch. Do your tuning. When you find a signal that you want to try to home in on, then you switch in the tuned speaker or resonant speaker and tweak it up from there. But I've never actually used one myself. I've seen videos of them, and I'm just going to try to start building them. So I was just curious what you had. Back to that.
There's one other factor I should bring out here, and that is when you're listening to that very weak signal, the very weak signal has to have a specific amount of power to it for the human hearing with 50 hertz of bandwidth, noise equivalent bandwidth, to be able to hear it. And if you're listening to a very broadband group of noise, and you've got the power turned up, the audio amplitude turned up loud enough that the weak signal you're listening to is above the right amount of energy, now the total power of all of that noise going into your hearing system can be excessive. One of the guys who did a lot of moon bounce operating, W4FZ, I think was his call letters, a guy who lived in Virginia. I'm trying to think of the name of the town right now, one of the famous towns from the Civil War, anyhow, I'm trying to think of his name also, a guy who I know very well way back from the 1970s. I think he's a silent key now. Because of many, many hours of many days and years of listening to very loud signals going into his earphones to listen to weak signals on moon bounce, I think it's a contributing factor to how his hearing became damaged. That's a theory on my part. Now, there's a person who want to make a comment. Please start off slowly with your call letters, your name, and then your comment, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
K2RIW in the group. This is Rich, WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Rich, UPS, I have two solutions, one very low-tech, one very high-tech. First, the low-tech. Stop somewhere at a Rite Aid or a CVS and get yourself a few plastic dollar tumblers. Might as well get a few different sizes. Very cheap plastic tumblers. Stick your cheap speaker facing downward into the tumbler, glue or tape it in place, and you have your resonant speaker. The other solution is the Soda Beams Varilaser digital audio filter. Very cheap, nice little board, sodabeams.co.uk, and that will give you your digital audio filter with extremely high skirts but no ringing. K2RIW in the group, WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike.
Good sounding information. I thank you, Rich. And K2UPS, go right ahead, Dust. With any further comments, bills, or whatever, K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, mobile, in West Virginia, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS mobile. Well, first off, I'm not having an issue with bad filtering in my rig. I have seen the Kenwood 590 has very good filtering in it, and also my favorite rig, the little Elecraft KX3D QRP radio. Has extremely narrow filtering. It'll go down to 50 hertz with practically no ringing at all. That works great, but I'm just interested in playing around with these tuned speakers and try to build some of them. But I do listen to CW for hours on end when I'm home sometimes. Not at loud volume, though, so hopefully that won't be an issue. And the Elecraft, I know, and some other radios have some interesting audio effects that they can put in. If you're listening to the signal through stereo speakers or a stereo headphones, you can get quasi-stereo where they delay, a slight delay between the two, your two ears. So it kind of opens up the sound. If you're just listening to a CW signal, it sounds like it's coming right between your eyes, like right in your forehead. It's centered. It's like listening to AM over FM stereo. This opens it up, makes it a little bit easier to listen to. And another thing they have is called CW mapping. As you tune across the band, when you first start hearing the CW signal, depending on if you're approaching it from the top or the bottom, you can hear it, let's say, as a low signal. And then it's going to increase in frequency until when you're centered on the guy, say at 600 hertz or 800 hertz, whatever you have your radio set for, it's going to sound like it's directly inside your head. But when you first hear, say, the low frequency, it's going to be only in your left ear. As you get closer to centered frequency, you can hear it moving literally between your ears until it's centered. And then as you tune past him, the frequency will increase and he will disappear at your right ear. It's a little freaky the first couple times you do that. But it's another interesting digital effect that you can do with some of the newer radios. Back to you, Dick.
That sounds like a lot of fun there, Rich, to play with the human hearing system like that. Another thing that I've heard people do is to use two separate antennas, maybe one horizontal and one vertically polarized, maybe two separate dipoles that are on opposite ends of the property going into two separate receivers. And each receiver... one receiver goes to the left ear and one receiver goes to the right ear. So as the signal goes through selective fading and angle of arrival changes and whatever, your three-dimensional hearing, so to speak, your spatial effects of the hearing can give you a hint about what's going on with that signal as it goes through fading and polarization shifts, Faraday rotation. Almost any signal reflected off the ionosphere, regardless of what polarization it starts out at, gets rotated in polarization some number of times in the process of each individual reflection of the ionosphere and then the Earth. When it gets to you, you'd be amazed how many times a signal that's transmitted purely vertical from London, by the time it gets to you, could be purely horizontally polarized because of what the ionosphere does. It's called Faraday rotation. And the moonbounce people, particularly on 2 meters, have to worry about Faraday rotation. Let me drop it. Your ionosphere is a plasma. That means it's made out of charged particles. Some of those electrons have been removed from some of those air molecules. And so it's a conductive medium, the ionosphere, when it's being bathed with ultraviolet light from the sun. And whenever a magnetic field plus a plasma are mixed together and a radio signal propagates through that medium, Faraday rotation is the science that describes to you, once you know the strength of the magnetic field and the characteristics of the plasma and the angles involved, you can predict how much rotation you're going to get per meter or per kilometer, so to speak, how much polarization rotation you're going to get. So the guy is doing 2 meter moonbounce. Can quite often have the problem of the guy you're talking to off the moon, you and he are both co-polarized, but that signal from your QTH goes through the ionosphere up to the moon, reflects off the moon, goes to the ionosphere, a different part of it again, to go into your buddy's antenna, and by the time it gets there, it can be the wrong polarization, and there's a rate of that polarization rotation. So the serious moon bouncers have an antenna that can be rotated in polarization, usually mechanically, but occasionally electronically they do that, in order to pick up that super weak signal. So, how soon, Rich, do you think you're going to be building this acoustic resonator? That's what you're really building. You're building a tuned pipe. Let me drop this. You're building a kind of an organ pipe, Rich, that favors your particular 700 hertz, maybe, favorite frequency. So your tuned organ pipe will have a loudspeaker at one end in order for you to do your weak CW listening. So how soon do you think you'll have that operating? Because there may be a bunch of people that want to visit you to hear what it sounds like. Okay, to Uncle Papa Sierra. Oh, by the way, also tell us, we're getting light drizzle all day today on Long Island and about 65 or so degrees Fahrenheit. So where you are in West Virginia, what's the weather like? K2UPS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS Mobile. Well, it's currently 61 degrees and it's raining moderately here. It's been raining off and on almost all day since we've left Louisville, Kentucky at 3 o'clock. So, but it's been wet roads the whole time and it looks like it's going to follow me all the way home. As far as when I get to put one of these together, it'll depend on when my friend prints it out and then when I get the free time at home to assemble it. But I am interested in seeing how it is, and not necessarily just for weak signal, but just for any CW listening. You know, if it's nearby, I don't know if the stations are close together or whatever, just to see how well it works. And possibly even using it like for field day use, see how well it comes across where you're really trying to knock out the other guys. So it's an interesting low-tech way to solve a filtering issue. But I know there are some good ones out there, and that soda beam one, I have seen that. That's an excellent little device, very small. You can fit it into just about any radio you have. So that's good ideas. Thank you.
That little thing that you can fit into almost any radio, is it tunable? Can you change its bandwidth and its skirt selectivity and its ringing factor? Are any of its parameters are changeable, Rich? And if so, how do you do that? Are you talking to that with a computer of some kind, with a, I can't think of the name of the cables they use on computers to communicate. K2UPS, K2LIW, good, Rich.
I believe it is adjustable through a knob that would, I guess, extend out the case. They sell the tiny board, and it is tiny. We're talking maybe like 1 by 2 inches or possibly even smaller than that. They have different ones that'll work with different ranges that'll work for CW or for sideband. And they also, I believe, sell a case that you can put it in to mount it near the radio, but it can also be mounted inside the radio. There's more information, I think, on that website, and maybe the other gentleman who mentioned might have some more info, but it really is a great little device. It's very inexpensive for what it does, and it's extremely small. You could probably put it in an 817 without any problem.
GXM? GXM, give us the full call and name. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW. Oh, it's Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
WB2 Golf X-ray, Mike, Rich. Yes, actually the soda beams is an audio filter. It can be inside the radio or you can build it in its own enclosure with input and output jacks. It's called the Vara Laser. It's not to be confused with the dual filters that soda beams also sells. They sell dual filter boards. This is not that. This is a completely variable digital audio filter. You can vary the bandwidth, and you can vary the center frequency. And you can narrow, you can zero in on any frequency you want. And that's what this Vara Laser board does. Now, I would also, again, not look over the cheap plastic tumbler resonant frequency enclosure you can do. That might solve your problem in about 50 seconds. WB2GXM.
I have the impression there, Rich, that you've been into digital signal filtering, digital signal processing boards, and so on. This soda beam or Vari Laser thing, roughly how many dollars is that? Sounds like it's a nice, cute little circuit. But if you're willing to spend more money and willing to use more volume, I'll bet you there are brand names out there of digital signal processing systems, either IF or audio, which may be fed with a USB cable to a desktop computer, where you can do all kinds of fancy tuning if you're willing to spend some more money. So tell me the price of the soda beam, and tell me what you're familiar with when it comes to, if I wanted higher fidelity and more knobs, so to speak, by way of digital commanding of a circuit that does this kind of processing, who makes it, how many dollars, and how much tuning can I do? Can I even shape the passband as well as shape the skirts? WB2GXM, K2RIW, good, Rich.
WB2GXM. Well, there are many audio filters, of course. There are hundreds or maybe even thousands you can buy. You know, I have a few old Heathkit used filters, which I like. But as far as I can tell, nothing currently touches this soda beams Vara Laser kit. It's not actually a kit. It's a finished board that you just hook your you hook your controls and input and output onto. The figure $35 or so comes to mind. I don't remember exactly what the figure is. It's not very expensive. And I really can't name by name specifically any other solution right now. I mean, like I said, there are many, many ways to skin this cat, WBTGXM.
Very fine, Rich. You don't have to name the other guy.